Davis Phenopter here with Matt Ford. Beers in hand. It's just the two of us this week, but we're going to have a lot to talk about after the return of the Bundesliga. Werder Bremen and Gladbach are still in the top four, and we're still wondering whether a team can compete in the Champions League and still compete in the top four spot in the Bundesliga. We also get to our Shout from the Rose Zed section, but first, after Bayern ending their losing streak, we have to start in Wolfsburg. So Bayern Munich beat Wolfsburg 3-1 over the weekend, putting an end to their very dramatic three-game winless streak, two-game losing streak. I mean, it was definitely a good bounce-back performance for a team that, even though they were playing with 10 men at some point, they looked much better than the team that went into the international break. Do you agree, Matt?
Yeah, overall, I think, yeah, definitely conclude that it was a much more rounded team performance from Bayern. I mean, let's not take away from the fact they were playing against Wolfsburg, so, and with all due respect, those a part of that four game run where they struggled, they did come up against teams who were admittedly quite high flying. Obviously Hertha Berlin have started the season really, really well.
So in sixth place now,
yeah. And they were top four for a while. So yeah, perhaps in hindsight, and it will be a disservice to Hertha to say that was a shock that they beat Bayern. I mean, they're doing really well at home. And the same applies to Bayern's defeat to Gladbach as well. Gladbach, another team, obviously now second, and we'll get onto them later. Looking really, really good. Wolfsburg was nowhere near that level. So from that, yeah, from that sense, not really a surprise that Bayern got back to winning ways there. But yeah, I think Kovac made some relatively brave and interesting changes. Obviously, I think we'll get onto the fact later that Müller, Boateng, Ribéry all started and remained on the bench for 90 minutes. James Rodriguez has not been particularly in favour under Kovac, has he? But he started and scored a fantastic goal as well. In the second half, Serge Gnabry started. I thought that was quite an important message and quite brave from Kovac, and that he's looking to start that transition. So yeah, not the toughest of opponents, but overall a satisfying weekend for Bayern Munich on the pitch. I think we'll get onto off the pitch later.
Yeah, we definitely have to get up to off the pitch later. But it is strange that performance was what followed that press conference. And obviously, we'll get to a little bit more on the press conference later. But it's a really good point with the bravery. I think bravery is the right word from Kovac to leave those players out of the team. Now, you could say with Boateng and with Ribéry that they were dealing with fitness issues. Ribéry is not expected to play. He actually didn't travel with the team to Athens for the Champions League match, and Boateng had just come off of an injury that kept him out of the second Germany game against France. So those players you can kind of understand, but Müller was the one that was really surprising to me, and it definitely was justified that he wasn't in the team.
Yeah,
and
you could Müller, it definitely wasn't a fitness or any sort of issue like that. Well, that was purely a form decision,
right? And you saw you saw the players that replaced him. Serge Gnabry really looks like the best forward player in Bayern's team right now. James Rodriguez, like you said, had a terrific goal and was terrific in that playmaking role. And Arjen Robben got sent off, but also still was doing some decent Arjen Robben things before he got sent off. But I do want to applaud, by the way, Guido Winkmann for actually showing him a yellow card for that dive in the penalty area. That's a yellow card that he probably should have seen maybe at least 10 more times in his career. And it's just ironic that was also one of the cards, obviously, that led to his red card later in the game. But yeah, you just saw so much more movement from this team. And this was a team before the international break where the players were just really standing around waiting for the ball to come to them before they actually did anything. And you saw a little bit more interchange with Serge Gnabry and with James going out to the wing at times, and Lewandowski also going to the wing at times and just trying to get involved with the play. Lewandowski obviously scored twice, so he showed the form that we are used to seeing. Of course, it's Wolfsburg, a team that he scored 5 goals in 8-9 minutes against. But still, I mean, this is a play that you also really need to get going. So overall, I think it was a very important performance for Bayern Munich.
No, I agree. I think going forward, that's exactly what I want to see more from Niko Kovac. There have been a few rumours and suggestions swirling around, haven't there, that especially during that 4-game mini crisis, as they're calling it, that certain dressing room voices were turning against Niko Kovac. The extent to which those rumours are substantiated, we'll never know.
Bayern certainly don't think that they're substantiated.
Well, yeah, Bayern will call them fake news. But I think if there was to be any truth in those sort of rumours, then any disaffection within the ranks would be coming from the older, established, you know, Bayern Munich old guard, to which Boateng, Hummels, Müller, Ribery certainly belong. So from that point of view, it was a very brave and very respectful, I think, decision from Kovac to leave them on the bench. And yeah, a good time for Bayern going forward. The Müller thing, I think you did a piece today, didn't you, pointing out Müller's dropping form. He struggled for Bayern since the end of last season, really. Is it 6 or 7 games for Germany as well without a goal now?
Well, it's interesting because when Jupp Heynckes came back, Jupp Heynckes obviously knows how to tap into his potential, and Niko Kovac just hasn't really done that yet. It's not like Müller is playing in different positions than he did under Heynckes or even under Pep Guardiola, but he still hasn't been able to. I mean, Müller is a very intelligent player. He doesn't necessarily need someone to tell him to where to stand. But it's not just about where Müller goes; it's where everybody else goes as well. And the fact that Kovac hasn't really figured out how to get the best out of Müller and the players around Müller, that's what's somewhat worrying.
Do you not think there's a contradiction though in that the sort of football that Kovac perhaps wants to start playing with Bayern and the sort of football that his team will be forced to play if he relies on Thomas Müller? Because it does tend to slow Bayern unit down. I'm not suggesting that Müller is therefore finished and Müller has absolutely no role to play and that he's absolutely useless. I'm not suggesting that for 1 minute, but I do think he slows it down slightly. And I think when you see James starting, you see Gnabry starting, you see the way they can link up, it adds so much pace and potency to Bayern's attack. And I mean, for me, if that's the way Kovac wants to go with Bayern and try and stamp his authority on the team and his identity on the team, I think that's the direction to go in. And if that is the case, then surely there's probably not a long-term place.
Yeah, I mean, I don't put the blame completely on Kovac. I mean, I also put the blame on the fact that Bayern Munich haven't replaced Frank Ribery or Arjen Robben, two players that clearly aren't as quick as they used to be, and also players that made Thomas Müller into the player that he has been at Bayern Munich.
Do you think Kingsley Coman has got a future under Kovac? And once he gets back,
I think, yeah, I mean, he started. Coman definitely started the first game of the season. I think that he's definitely in Kovac's plans. I think it would be interesting to see a team where Serge Gnabry and Kingsley Coman were starting on either wing, and then you have Thomas Müller in the middle. And
this time next year, they'll have Christian Pulisic too, won't they?
Very possibly. Or Nabil Fekir was a name that was floated around, although I don't think he is a winger as well.
Anthony Martial was a very vague rumour at some point.
That too. Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's ultimately not up to Kovac it's clearly not up to Kovac who is in Bayern Munich's squad. It might even be up to Hasan Salihamidzic
Is that a good thing that Kovac hasn't got that sort of say? Because he's the new man in charge. He's been tasked with this Bayern Munich transition.
Right, but I don't know how involved he is with the transfers. I would assume, based on the patterns from Bayern Munich in the past, that he's not as involved in transfers as other managers are
I think we've said in previous weeks that I don't think any of us are really convinced that Bayern have really let loose the purse strings for Kovac. I think they want to wait at least a year to see that if he's really the man to trust with 100, 200 million euros to spend.
And I think they just have, with in the case of Thomas Müller, they just have a lot of players like, I mean, Thiago plays much deeper now, but players like Thiago, players like James Rodriguez that really play Müller's position. And Kovac has been trying to play James and Müller at the same time. And the jury is still out whether that combination works. And Müller like I said a few weeks ago, I mean, it's some people consider Müller to be versatile. I consider him to be positionless. And that is dangerous for a player who is trying to get a place in the side under a new manager or a new coach, as it is in Germany. But it's interesting because of how much of Bayern's success hinges on Müller. I mean, you look at the numbers. I did the numbers today. Of the games that Thomas Müller has scored or assisted a goal, Bayern Munich have won 90% of those games. When he doesn't score or assist a goal, basically with a goal contribution, it's down to just under 60%. That's a huge drop-off, and it shows that Bayern Munich are still extremely reliant on Thomas Müller, and that's why it's not a good thing that Kovac has not tapped into his potential quite yet.
Yeah, then again, you can argue on the other side that they didn't need him against Wolfsburg, and admittedly, yes, it was only Wolfsburg, and they are having significant issues of their own this season. But I'm personally much more convinced with the performances of James and Gnabry. I think it's a much more exciting Bayern team. I think it benefits Lewandowski too, because those balls are getting into his feet more, and there's much less, for want of a better word, dilly-dallying around the box, which often tends to come when Müller's on the ball. It's not necessarily Müller's fault that by the time the pass then comes, whichever defence up against is already back with 9-10 men in the box behind the ball, which makes it impossible, especially because they've only got one man in Lewandowski up front. So yeah, I've been simply much more impressed with the interchange between the likes of Thiago and James and Gnabry. And for me, yeah, that's got to be the future for Bayern Munich going forward. And I want to see Kovac continuing to have the guts to persevere with that.
Yeah. Well, he's a coach that wants to rotate the squad, and he definitely has the chance to rotate the squad now because they have games against AEK Athens in the Champions League. They have games against Mainz and Freiburg in the Bundesliga, and they play SV Rodenhausen, who is in the Regionalliga West in Germany, in the German Cup. So that's definitely a softer part of the fixture list where he could maybe give a run to certain lineups that he thinks could work and give them momentum going into the tougher fixtures of the season, like Borussia Dortmund in November, or even like Ajax again in the Champions League when they go to the Netherlands.
I think the issue of rotation's key, and I think it was Kovac, wasn't it, over the weekend, who pointed out to journalists who'd questioned that, and he said, look, we have to stop with this idea that rotation is somehow damaging or somehow a wrong decision on my part.
And yeah,
I thought he was spot on. His argument was that, you know, this is top-level Bundesliga football / Champions League football. Absolutely no one can play at that level consistently for however many weeks throughout the season, on Wednesday, on Saturday. Rotation is absolutely part of it, and it will not stop. So I think that, combined with some of his personnel decisions, leaving Müller on the bench, etc., certainly shows an authority and almost a comfort and confidence in Kovac's role at Bayern, which is impressive for such a relatively young and relatively inexperienced manager at such a massive club. And he does look relaxed and confident in his own skin. From a Bayern point of view, if they continue along that road with the financial backing that will come eventually for Kovac, they may be back on the up. But let's not see a return to this slower, purely possession-based football, which unfortunately does seem to be incorporated or embodied a little bit by Thomas Müller.
Yeah. How much do you think that we'll see that on Tuesday when they travel to Athens? Because Athens is most likely
going
to be a
team. You think Müller will start, don't you? You think he'll get his chance?
I've seen some media outlets in Germany suggest that Müller would get the start, and I'm assuming that since Müller sat on the bench and did not play at all against Wolfsburg, that there is a much more than a non-zero chance that he starts.
My guess is that he would start, and with all due respect to AEK Athens, who I admittedly know absolutely nothing about, I don't imagine the quality is that ridiculously high. So I imagine I think starting Müller there would certainly be an understandable idea. I think he'd be able to dominate a game like that against an opponent that Bayern Munich really should be beating. Yeah. But we said that about Ajax, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. So that performance against Wolfsburg came after a very fiery press conference on Friday. And it was, we were actually together when it occurred. We both saw that Niko Kovac was giving a press conference at 11, and the three Bayern bosses were doing a press conference at noon. A lot of people had speculated that it might have to do something with Niko Kovac. And then I think we both realized, well, why would Niko Kovac give a press conference in only for the Bayern front office to basically sack him the next minute?
And then, as I said, the actual performance that Kovac delivered in that press conference was so calm and relaxed.
Yeah, a lot of people were saying how calm he was.
So I think we got the impression pretty quickly, well, I'm pretty sure he's not being fired, because I think at one point he was asked, wasn't he? He's like, oh, do you have any idea about what this conference is next with Rummenigge, Hoeneß and Solihull? And Kovac just laughed and smiled and was like, well, we'll see, won't we? It'll be a nice surprise. And then walked out. So I think he knew what was coming.
Yeah, do you think he knew what was coming?
I do, yeah. Given that reaction, I think he knew what was coming.
So obviously what was coming, in case you missed it, was a complete undressing of the German media. Both Karl-Heinz Rummenigge and Uli Hoeneß singled out particular reports and particular stories and referred to some reporters by name in addressing the negative coverage that the German national team and Bayern Munich had received over the recent weeks.
Reporting on Bayern Munich and the Bayern Munich players who were disappointed for Germany over the international break. They were singled out as reports which were, what were the words they used? Shameless reporting.
Yeah, ludicrous, outrageous.
Outrageous reporting, disrespectful reporting.
Yeah. Definitely a thesaurus full of words to condemn the media in every way they possibly could. And you saw, a lot of people, a lot of people on Twitter said that it was very Trumpian. That was the word that was used. And I think it's a buzzword now on social media. But in a way, if you look at it, it kind of was. If you look at the content and the tone with which the content was said, I mean, it was basically an attack on the press, on quote-unquote fake news. Bayern Munich saying that these reports are false, and the fact that we have our own, and perhaps most dangerously saying that we have our own ways of reporting on our club now. We don't necessarily need you anymore. And they didn't say that exactly, but they did mention that they have their own FC Bayern TV and their own website.
I think they were pretty explicit about that. They mentioned FC Bayern TV by name and said that it was their intention in future to rely heavily on that, more heavily on that internal channel. I think this whole phenomenon around that press conference was problematic on a couple of levels. Firstly, let's just limit it first of all to the pure issue within football, although I think it goes beyond that. Purely within football, it does seem to be an issue that Bayern Munich certainly seem to be of the belief that they are big enough and important enough, and that's their words, not mine. They called themselves, we are the most important club in Germany, and it's about time the most important club in Germany takes a stand. They seem to think they do not need the media anymore. They don't need journalists anymore. They don't need us anymore. They have their own channels, their own reach, their own audience,
their own social media campaigns,
their own methods of connecting with fans, or others might call them consumers.
Their own offices in New York and Shanghai and possibly other parts of the world.
For their purposes, they don't need the media. So from their point of view, you can, in a bizarre way, actually understand that from a PR point of view, from a marketing point of view, from a financial point of view. They don't need an independent press who are potentially likely to report negatively. They can why risk negative reports when you can rely on your own internal media? So that's definitely where they're coming from. Is that a good thing? No, it's certainly not. And simply in football, that's an undesirable way to go. But more importantly, outside of football, it sends a very, very dangerous message. As much as we all love football, we're all football fans, we're all passionate about the sport, it is, in the greater scheme of things, comparatively unimportant. But, and I pointed this out in a piece I wrote on Friday, I think it's extremely dangerous when influential and as powerful men as Karl-Heinz Rummenigge and Uli Hoeneß at an institution like Bayern Munich start coming out with comments like, and these are quotes, false facts and untruths. That's only a short hop away from fake news, isn't it? Suggesting that the media are lying, suggesting that journalists are out to get Bayern Munich or have some sort of agenda. As I said, in a purely football context, that's relatively unimportant because we can all get on with our lives and we all have more important things to do. But in the great scheme of things, sowing that seed of doubt that the media are not to be believed, that the journalists are lying, that these truths are not real, these facts are not real, that actually, dear general public, all you need for your information is our internal private marketing channel, Bayern TV. That's an extremely dangerous message, I think.
Yeah, but it is important to point out that this isn't the controlling of news and the news cycle in German football that is not new. I mean, we talked about over the summer that the DFL got basically a talking to say the least, for publishing a negative-ish article about the German national team, and they got in talking to by the DFB. And you have, I mean, there's probably a litany of journalists in Germany that write something in English that basically are told that they have to, they're told that they by clubs that they want interviews and they want everything basically read through by the PR people at these clubs. That there was an instance that happened with me. I'm sure that there's an instance that happened with you as well at some point. That basically there was an editor published a piece that someone in a club, I won't say the club's name, but someone in the club didn't read over. And I got very angry emails with capital letters saying you were supposed to have us read this over before this was published. If these things were published, we don't. If these basically they wanted to try to control what was said, and the editors were not Bundesliga people, and they said, well, we can't wait for everybody to publish the piece, they can't wait for everybody to get back to them in order to publish the piece. But that's the way, and one of the things that the person said to me was that's the way that it works in Germany.
That's not just how it works in Germany. I think in football journalism, in England, in Spain as well, in several countries, that is the way it works, because ultimately we are dealing with football clubs which, whether we like it or not as fans, in a legal sense, are private businesses, especially in the UK, perhaps slightly less so in Germany because of 50+1 and the influence of a membership, but they're still private clubs. And so, yeah, technically, from a legal point of view, have the right to act like any private company would, and that means that their dealings with the public, with the wider audience outside of their private world, is undisputedly and inevitably more marketing than it is journalism. And yeah, there is a growing problem. We've all been in situations where clubs have insisted that certain lines in reports aren't acceptable, that they don't go along with the club line, because ultimately they're interested in marketing and sending out a positive image about their brand or product than they are about independent reporting. So that's nothing new. And the question is, going forward in 2018, in an age where these mega super clubs have such powerful channels of their own, do we need independent journalism anymore? And we're talking about my job, your job as well. That's what we're talking about. Is this necessary in football anymore? Ask Uli Hoeneß and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge. The answer is clearly no. But then again, how do they see football? They see football and their Bayern Munich as, like they said, the most important thing in the world, up on their little cloud. The arrogance really was absolutely staggering. But from a football supporter's point of view, is that really the road we want to go down? Are we all so blinkered and blinded as football fans that we only want to read the completely sugar-coated and positive PR gags pumped out by our own teams? And I think that is perhaps subconsciously the case with some supporters. I can only say from a personal point of view, I support United, but the last thing I would do is ever go to Man United's homepage to read articles about Man United, simply because it's not neutral. I want to read articles about any football club, which is written from a neutral point of view. Because otherwise, all you're getting is marketing. Yeah. And we're not in it for that, are we?
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
That's true. One thing I definitely want to get to about this press conference is Hasan Salihamidžić, because
yes.
he, I think we both agreed that the anger with which he spoke in that press conference about Niko Kovac, about basically the players, was almost just building on the anger that Ole Gunnar had.
Yeah, it didn't seem totally authentic, did it?
Right, and you also, if you think about it, I mean, you look at the level that Ole Gunnar went to in terms of anger. That's kind of was the bar that was almost set for him, I want to say. That was the level of anger that he could go to himself.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to watch.
You just have to wonder if Ole Gunnar talked with a much more measured tone, if Hasan Salihamidžić would have talked so angrily as he did.
Yeah, I don't think Ole Gunnar talks in measured tones. He either has
he either has
silence or absolute, utter, thoughtless rage. But yeah, it did. We've speculated before, haven't we? Ever since the appointment of Salihamidžić as sporting director at Bayern Munich, that how much power does he really have? We know that it's been reported that Philipp Lahm turned down the job because he was not going to be offered a seat on the board. Hasan Salihamidžić has taken that role in the knowledge that the sporting director will not have a seat on the board, which clearly puts him a few echelons beneath Rummenigge, and Rummenigge as head of as board chairman, and Hernes as club president, and that led us to speculate, hasn't it, that Salihamidžić was actually quite a safe appointment for Bayern's bosses, someone who could carry their influence onto the bench, keep an eye on the new coach, maybe just be a bit of a puppet for the club leadership, really.
Yeah.
I think
puppet. The puppet word is maybe a little, Hasan Salihamidžić does a little bit of a disservice.
Does it? I thought before that press conference, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the word puppet is a bit extreme.
Yeah.
But there was a moment in that press conference
the
where
Salihamidžić
moved to answer a question about Bayern's transfer policy.
Or was it either that or James Rodriguez? The actual question doesn't really matter, to get to your point.
Yeah, you're right. I can't remember which question it actually was. But he moved to answer a question, and was cut off mid-answer by Rummenigge, sat on the other side of Hernes, about 2 meters away down the podium.
The most awkward camera pan at a press conference.
There was a quick camera pan
ever seen,
as Rummenigge raised his arm and basically said to Salihamidžić, "No, stop, that's enough." And it was quite clear how that hierarchy is structured at Bayern Munich.
Yeah.
Rummenigge and Hernes are the two big men, and yeah, as I said before, I used words like arrogance, I used words like entitlement in this piece, I used words like privilege, hypocrisy, and I stand by all of them. I think it was absolutely incredible what we saw on Friday, and it shows exactly where they are, the absolute hypocrisy of the men. At one point, Rummenigge quoted the German constitution.
Right.
This is how bizarre it got. And me and you were sat there watching it, baffled, weren't we? Like, he's literally quoting the basic law of the state, saying that, was it the human
Article one,
saying the rights, or was it the rights or the values of humans are inviolable. And well, I'm not sure to what extent the German constitution is in line with Qatar's constitution, but Bayern seem to have no issue dealing with them.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the German constitution says about taxes, but Ole Gunnar knows all about that as well.
One thing I want to get to too about Salihamidžić was so awkward when basically Rummenigge essentially tried to end the press conference. And Salihamidžić he was just like standing up awkwardly, didn't even know if he had permission to stand up from the press conference and leave, because his two bosses were sitting right there and he didn't want to leave. I mean, maybe if your boss is sitting next to you, you don't want to leave before they do. But at the same time, it was so bizarre. And
the whole thing taught us a lot about Bayern Munich, didn't it?
Yeah. One thing I want to ask before we move on. How much of a crisis was this actually at Bayern Munich?
Totally overblown. Okay. Yeah, of course there were issues, and we discussed the issues on this podcast, didn't we? We talked about them playing too slowly, moving the ball too slowly, not being able to get back into a game once they come behind, not taking chances. They were creating chances, and Kovac has been pointing that out. They just simply weren't taking them, so that was an issue up front. Again, without just name bashing, Thomas Müller was a main culprit there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, issues of course. A lot of them can be put down to Kovac's teething problems, or maybe just still figuring out the direction he wants to go in. Let's also give credit, like I said, credit to Hertha with the 2-0 win and Gladbach with a 3-0 win. Credit to them.
Top six sides.
Ajax could have got away with more than just a point as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a mini little crisis, definitely, but not to be overblown.
Yeah, I mean, I think. A lot of people in the media were guilty of using the word crisis because it is somewhat of a buzzword. It's a word that works well on search engine optimization.
Maybe that's what Hernes and Rummenigge were getting at.
But when the defending champions are in sixth place in sixth place after seven match days for the first time in 8 years, I mean, that is a big deal. And I think Bayern fans do have to recognize that sixth place is relative. Sixth place, of course, for Borussia Mönchengladbach would be stellar, but that's also because Borussia Mönchengladbach isn't playing in the Champions League and they're trying to get back into Europe.
And Gladbach don't walk around calling themselves the most important club in the world.
Right, and yeah, so sixth place for Bayern Munich is something else entirely. All right, let's move on to Borussia Mönchengladbach because they and Werder Bremen are above Bayern Munich in the table right now. Bayern Munich moved up to fourth with their win against Wolfsburg, but Gladbach and Werder Bremen leapfrogged them immediately with their wins against Schalke and in terms of Werder Bremen and against Mainz in terms of Borussia Mönchengladbach. But let's get to Gladbach first because they are coming off that very impressive win against Bayern Munich. And they looked even more impressive against Mainz. Now, one could say that Mainz are a side that maybe a lot of people will have impressive performances against. But, Matt, that was still a performance to remember.
Gladbach looking really, really impressive. Really, really enjoyed watching them. And, in fact, you can say that going back a few years, actually, that when Gladbach click, especially with that the talent they have going forward, when they do click, they are fantastic to watch. It just happens all too rarely. Obviously, they struggled a lot of time last season without Alassane player. They didn't have a proper striker up front, so they often end up going around in circles quite a lot. Stindl struggled with injuries at times, and that's always a huge loss when he's not there. But when they all click the way they did in Munich 2 weeks ago and the way they did against Mainz yesterday, losing track of time, when they do click, they are fantastic to watch. And yeah, two games, seven goals, none conceded, really impressive. And I know you say Mainz have been struggling, and it is true, they've only scored four goals in their eight games so far. But going into yesterday's game, on the other hand, they had also only conceded four. So this is also a team which doesn't actually concede that many goals, but Borussia Mönchengladbach blew them away.
Yeah, the second highest goals total in the Bundesliga behind Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, 19 goals, I think, so far. Yeah.
And one of the players that has been getting a lot of goals is Jonas Hofmann.
Well, he got three of them yesterday.
Yeah, he got three. had a hat-trick yesterday, a former Borussia Dortmund academy product. And he moved to the club a couple years ago, Matt, but he's finally coming into his own in midfield, of all places. He was a winger at Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, and Dieter Hecking has moved him inside, and I think it's been a really, really brave move. Dieter Hecking has maybe not unfairly, but he has had a reputation down the years, quite a cautious coach. I think going back to day one, actually, I think we spoke to some Gladbach fans on day one against Leverkusen, didn't we, when I asked them about Dieter Hecking, and they tended to say, yeah, he's all right, but as Gladbach fans, obviously they're all still quite obsessed with the famous teams of the 70s and 80s. They want to see attacking football, they want to see like a new young Foles team coming through. That's all, yeah, fantastic for fans to expect that sort of thing, but there are high expectations in Mönchengladbach. And yeah, there was sort of a feeling that maybe Dieter Hecking is a little bit too cautious, maybe not quite as outgoing and exuberant as, say, Florian Kohfeldt, who we'll come on to later with Werder Bremen, or Julian Nagelsmann at Hoffenheim. But that's been quite a brave move, hasn't it? Not just bringing Hoffman into the middle in place of, well, in place of pretty much in place of Zakaria and Kramer, who both started on the bench against Mainz. And I thought that was impressive because those two do often start for Gladbach as almost like two holding midfielders in front of the back four, which can sometimes lead to a bit of a disconnect. They're very solid at the back, Gladbach, and they've got talent going forward, but absolutely nothing in the middle linking it up. Hoffman did that, and also a good shout-out to Florian Neuhaus as well, who was really, really impressive. Only 21, and was involved in three of the four goals on Sunday.
Yeah,
really impressive performance.
Florian Neuhaus was on loan at Fortuna Düsseldorf last season, and he's also, I believe he was one of, I mean, some second Bundesliga fan can correct me if I'm wrong, but he was a big contributor for last season as well. And you can see, I mean, it seems like that loan move really paid off for him and for Borussia Mönchengladbach, because he's quickly become a very significant contributor to their team.
What was impressive is that every time he picked the ball up in midfield, and this was the case in all three of those goals that he was involved in, he seemed to know exactly where he wanted to play his next pass, even before he received the ball. So his recycling of possession was really, really good. He received the ball and moved it on really, really quickly. The first goal was obviously started off a great move when he received the ball back to goal and then played in player, and that then developed via Hazard and then onto Hoffman. Really, really good passing move, which clearly left the Mainz defence, which had been quite solid up to that point, but clearly left them chasing shadows. Really, really good move. He was involved similarly, like starting off the attack for the second goal, and the final goal, which was actually Hoffman knocking it into an empty net from distance, but that was started when Gladbach won the ball back on the halfway line and Neuhaus quickly took over and played in Hoffman with the key ball that gave him the space to take it round the keeper and finish off. Really, really good vision for a lad who's only 21. Really, really impressed.
Yeah, I mean, we can, with their form right now, we probably can spend an hour gushing about Borussia Mönchengladbach right now, but I do want to mention Thorgan Hazard, because he may have one of the toughest roles in Europe of living up to his stellar older brother in Eden Hazard, and yet he is a terrific player in his own right. He started at the World Cup and has built on that. He has really taken, even though he was a solid player last season, it seems like, I don't know if you agree with this, I think he's taken a step up even further this season, and maybe it is because he has players like Florian Neuhaus around him, that he has players that he can target in Alisson Plea in the middle.
I think what's key now, though, he's no longer the only player in that Gladbach attack with pace. Often seen a bit disjointed at times last season, where you had the likes of Stindl and Raphael playing lovely, intricate football around the box, but not necessarily, it just didn't really link up with Hazard, who was looking for that run off the shoulder and the ball in behind. Now the two of them, him and Alisson Plea, are doing it, and the two of them linked up really, really well for that third goal. Great ball in from the left from Plea, and a fantastic finish from Thorgan Hazard in the middle. So yeah, I think that's helped him. There's a lot more pace in that Gladbach attack, isn't there?
What do we make of Dieter Hecking's situation? Because he has done really well with this team. He started off slow last season, but they still finished in the top half of the table. But he still has only signed until the end of the season. Gladbach, to my knowledge, have so far not made any attempt to extend his contract. Maybe that's just the circumstance. Maybe it's just in the season, both the club and Dieter Hecking want to focus on performances, and maybe a contract extension is coming. But it does seem odd that especially since I saw a lot of people on social media saying, or some comments, maybe not a lot, maybe I'm exaggerating to Bayern hating levels, but there are some people out there that said that Max Eberl has stuck with Dieter Hecking, and it seems like to me that's not necessarily the case, because he has a contract that's expiring at the end of the season.
I don't think there's ever, apart from the doubts from some of the some elements of the support which we talked about, I don't think his role within the club has ever really been that much in doubt.
Whether, but if that's the case, then why is his contract expiring?
Well, you'd have to ask Max Eberl, and maybe
of course,
then he'll give you a statement which you'll have to then redact make sure it conforms to club PR rules. But in terms of Dieter Hecking's future, I think it could be quite interesting if they end up in Europe again this year, which is certainly doable, maybe even Champions League if they keep this up. But I think at least, given the start they've had and the talent they have there, Europa League at the very, very least has got to be the aim. Your question is, can Dieter Hecking combine these two styles of football, the more conservative approach that he's known for and which he's mastered time and time again down the years, and which could come in very, very useful, especially if they end up playing Champions League football, but could be very useful in Europe. Getting the balance between that and this more outgoing and more expressive style that we've seen against Bayern and against Mainz, which I think could take them far in the Bundesliga, where I think they've got a lot more space to operate, and they're less likely to get hit on the break by dangerous teams. So yeah, if he can get that balance right going forward, then maybe it will be a sign that Hecking could be an even longer term solution for Gladbach.
Do you think an extension is going to come in soon?
I honestly don't know. What can I say? I don't know.
I could see something in the winter break, maybe if Gladbach are still in the top four. I would be surprised if Gladbach waited until the end of the season to extend his contract.
True. When you put it like that, I also wouldn't be surprised if we then saw something in winter. But don't go around quoting, "Oh, I heard on the Tribune podcast that he's got a new contract."
Yeah, there's full on speculation.
Untruth.
Yeah.
Shameless reporting.
Yeah. Let's move on to Werder Bremen, because they beat Schalke and I would say rather impressive form, and this is a Werder Bremen team, as I mentioned.
Rather impressive.
Yeah, I would say
more than rather impressive. It's really impressive.
Yeah, really impressive. I mean, Schalke did have some chances. I would say, even though I still don't understand what Domenico Tedesco is doing up front, but at the same time, you do definitely have to give credit to Werder Bremen, who are in the top three for the first time in a very long time and are playing a style of football that we also haven't seen Werder Bremen play in maybe almost a decade.
Loads of options in the 4-3-3. Been really good to watch the past few weeks. They would have been second, wouldn't they, if it wasn't for the fact that Gladbach went and scored four. So, really impressive so far. Obviously, Max Eggestein took the plaudits against Schalke, didn't he? Two really, really good finishes. Could have been a little bit more, actually, if it wasn't for... I can't remember the Schalke goalkeeper's name. It was the second...
Alexander Nuber.
Yes, making his first start. He pulled off a really good save from Kevin Mervald, didn't he, in the second half. So it could have been even more. Impressive performance from Werder Bremen. And it's been coming. You can't even say that... You can't really say that was a shock, can you?
No, you can't. That's true. I think the addition of Davy Klaassen, as Jonathan has previously said on this podcast, that was a big addition. I mean, he is the record signing, and it's important that he's playing so well. But to me, it seems what's odd to me still about Werder Bremen is that they still seem so dependent on Max Kruse. And I mean, it's great that he is a player who comes back and wants to get involved in the build-up play before making the run in behind the defense later on. But he can't be the guy that you depend on to help build up the play. I think Nuri Sahin had a good game.
Claudio Pizarro can't be the man that you call on off the bench to be adding extra goals either.
Yeah,
I think you're right. That probably is one area where particularly Davy Klaassen could add a little bit more clinicalness to his finishing.
Yeah. Because, Maximilian Eggestein, I think, has been very impressive. He seems like he can play the number eight role, a guy that is more box to box and can track back. But it just is when you see Nuri Sahin just passing the ball with Nicholas Meisander and Milos Veljkovic, it seems odd that you really need Max Kruse to come back, combined with some of these midfielders, in order to get the ball to move up the field. That's not always the case, of course, but I still wonder what this team would be like if Max Kruse wasn't there, because he did miss a good a decent amount of time last season and also the season before, and I mean he is on the wrong side of 30, so you do not know if he's going to play all 34 games in the Bundesliga.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that striking department is one area where, yeah, if Bremen are gonna in future take the next step, or if you ask anyone at Werder Bremen where the next area to be focused on, to be built up, it would be a more long term solution up front. Obviously, Martin Hanek is there, scored a lot of goals for Hanover, but obviously out injured at the moment. But again, I don't think either.
And when he came on, I mean, he hasn't really made an impact that I thought he would.
Exactly. And I think even behind him, I'm a huge fan of Yuya Osako, but he's not the out-and-out goal scorer that you need. He links up play really well. So yeah, I think that's fair to say that's the next building block for Bremen. But that should definitely not take away from what they've achieved so far. I think the key so far has been that midfield three. Yeah. Really, really impressive. Bagfried and normally in their class, and you've mentioned, is impressive. Max Eggestein has showed how lethal he can be going forward. But even when they're not there, I think there's some really, really savvy transfer dealings. You mentioned Klaassen, a really, really progressive replacement for Delaney. Not saying that Delaney did the job that he does and was taken to Dortmund for. He's a holding midfielder. He breaks up play.
Very active as well.
Yeah, active, but more defensive-minded. The conservative choice at Werder Bremen would be bringing a like-for-like and purely bringing... Remember, they brought in Yuri Sahin, who also plays that role. Although,
well, he plays a little deeper role, but I see your
deeper,
point.
And arguably slightly more cultured in terms of his passing. No offence to Thomas Delaney, and sorry, John. I know he's a big fan as well. Bringing in Davy Klaassen as that replacement, I thought, just moved Werder Bremen's game a good 10, 15 yards up the pitch.
That's
probably what's getting them in the positions where they're able to cause teams like Schalke such problems.
And you have to wonder, when you have a player like Max Eggestein, who was started out as more of an attacking midfielder, but is starting to evolve, I mean, into a more box-to-box player. He still has somewhat of a way to go, and I disagree with some people who say that he's ready for a call-up to the senior national team. But at the same time, I think that maybe the reason why they thought that they could move on from Thomas Delaney was because they had Eggestein and they wanted him to become one of the focal points of their midfield. I wanted to ask, before we move on to something related to this topic, where do you think Bremen's midfield ranks in the Bundesliga right now? I'm just curious.
Up there, I think I'd say. Behind Bayern and Dortmund, certainly. I think Schalke have significant issues in that department, especially since the departure of Goretzka, so I'd probably have Bremen up above them. Given the injuries to the likes of Baumgartlinger and Arangis at Leverkusen, that is definitely an issue for them. We've even seen Kai Havertz dropping deeper at times for Leverkusen, haven't we? Which is awful to see. on so many levels. So yeah, really, really impressive, and just good backup all around. Bagford is out injured, so Sahin starts. If Klaassen can't do the full 90 minutes, Mervard comes on and can be dangerous up front. If Eggestein, if his more direct style of play isn't working, Yuya Osako is there to add a little bit more culture. And a different sort of effort on goal, cutting in from whichever flank he's on. Yeah, really, really flexible, and probably the most impressive thing that Florian Kohfeldt has done. But I think I think you are right to point out that the next building block will be to sort out parts of that offensive trio or striker up front.
I think you can make a case that Hertha Berlin is maybe possibly better than Werder Bremen, but I think behind Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund, although with some of the performances that both of those midfielders put in, I mean, you could argue that Werder Bremen had looked better at times. I do think it's definitely one of the three or four best midfielders in Germany, and that's not something that you would say about Werder Bremen a couple of years ago. Yeah.
No, really good. That's all credit to Kohfeldt and all credit to Frank Baumann, the sporting director. I think there's an interesting contrast, isn't there? I think obviously you were asking questions there about, you know, where can they improve, how can they get even better, and you're right to ask that. It has to be, you know, the debate has to be moved forward. But if you ask those questions to Kohfeldt, and he was asked those questions after the win, looking ahead, and you know, where can this go? How can you get better? Can you get Europe? They're living 100% in the here and now. They're not looking at the table. All right, yeah, they've said before the campaign started, we want to get Europe, and why not? Yeah, why not give yourself an aim? But he said they're not going to start getting carried away with that. They're just going to enjoy where they are for the time being. I've just noted down some of the words that Frank Baumann has come out with recently. Not getting excited, concentration, normality, focus, down to earth. That is exactly what is summing up Werder Bremen at the moment, and let's just hope it can continue for more than just one season.
Well, you could also argue that the reason why teams like Gladbach and Bremen are where they are is because they aren't playing in Europe. And even though they aspire to be in Europe, they aren't in Europe at the moment. You saw that with Schalke last season, and when Hoffenheim were knocked out of the Europa League early, they made a very significant charge up the table all the way up to third place. And you see teams like Leverkusen and Schalke. Schalke just on the edge of the relegation zone. Leverkusen fighting for a draw against Hannover. I mean, it really is an advantage not to play in the Bundesliga. But we said that last season. I mean, with the Bundesliga also, in order to have that presence in Europe, they need the same teams to be in Europe, right? So it's still a tad worrying, isn't it? That there's still teams that are in Europe now that struggle to get back to it.
It's a recurring theme. How many times have we touched on this on the podcast and in various articles? Our colleague Matt Pearson has done the latest of them today. A really, really good piece. You know, it's catch 22 for German teams in Europe if they're not Bayern Munich or Borussia Dortmund, because they simply do not have the squads to compete. This year is yet another classic example. We saw Leverkusen and Schalke impress hugely last season when they didn't have to worry about playing in Europe. Leverkusen impressed with their attacking capabilities, and Schalke impressed with how solid they were at the back, and it got them, you know, it got Schalke up to second, and it saw Leverkusen miss out on the Champions League by about 3 or 4 goals. Look at them both now, struggling. Schalke have failed to build up. Tedesco is struggling to prove that he can do more than simply organise a well-organised defence. And Heiko Herrlich is struggling to prove that he can get the best out of what is perhaps after Gladbach, Dortmund and Bayern, the most exciting and potent-looking attack on paper at Bayer Leverkusen. And it's no surprise, because they've got absolutely no time to work on this on the training ground. And the reason I make that point is because that's exactly what Julian Nagelsmann said last season, especially in the first half of the season when things weren't going too well for Hoffenheim, when they were still in that Europa League group. Nagelsmann said that, yeah, so much of the work that we do here is based in absolutely intense and meticulous planning. But when we only have 3 days or 2 or 3 days after a European game to prepare for the Bundesliga game, one of which is regeneration, there simply isn't the time to work on these developments in training and move a team onto the next level. They really are caught in between a rock and a hard place, aren't they? Because on the one hand, you get into Europe and
you get that extra money as well.
Yeah, it's the money, but also, it's also the expectation from a professional point of view, the players, that you want to do as well as you can at the highest level. So, of course, you're going to throw everything into European competition. The pressure from the fans, who, of course, are buzzing to see their team play in Europe and take them to different places and want to even go as far as they can. And like I said, the pressure from the money men, you know, to stay in the competition as long as possible.
Not just people inside the club, but also people who sponsor the club, who want to have their kit sponsor or their stadium sponsor, even from that point of view,
and I really am loath to talk about the financial importance in football, because it's really not what it should be about, but unfortunately we all know that that's what it is all about. Surely from a long-term point of view, it would be much better off if these, whether it was Schalke last year, whether it was Gladbach, whether it was Leverkusen, whether it could be Gladbach and Werder Bremen this year, even Hertha Berlin, any of these teams, yet when you get into Europe, especially the Champions League, recognize where you are. Do you have the squad to compete on two fronts? If not, do you have the money to boost it now? And if not, you have to come to the conclusion, which may be unfair on the players and the fans, but to say, right, we're going to take the 6 group games, we're going to enjoy our 3 European away trips for the fans, but the focus is going to be getting back here next season. And even from a financial point of view, that's surely more sensible in the long term.
All right, let's get to our Shout from Row Z section. Thank you all for voting this week. I know it was more of a snap poll this week, but we both had very busy weekends this week. There was a lot to do. The Bundesliga was back, but we appreciate you voting, and we are going to talk about, at your request, the Englishmen in the Bundesliga. There are two significant ones, obviously. There, I think Kalen Hines was in the Bundesliga, but has now been released by Wolfsburg, so he is no longer in the Bundesliga. But you have Rice Nelson scoring at the weekend, and you also have Jadon Sancho, who has 8 assists on the season. So I think it's proper to start with Rice Nelson, considering his recent form with Hoffenheim, the fact that he is getting more of a role in Hoffenheim, and the fact that he might be starting tomorrow for Hoffenheim against Olympique Lyon. So what have you made from Rice Nelson? That's one of the things in Germany. They say Rice Nelson instead of Reece Nelson. But what do you think that Reece Nelson has – what do you think of what he's done in Germany so far?
Really, really impressed. He started into that Hoffenheim team really, really well. I think Julian Nagelsmann pointed out when the loan move was made from Arsenal that he was looking explicitly for a player who could step into Serge Gnabry's shoes. Nagelsmann said as well at the time that he doesn't expect Reece Nelson to achieve that straight away. He recognises that Gnabry, I think both physically and in terms of his technique, was slightly more developed than Nelson is at the moment, and was a slight level ahead. Hence the interest from Bayern Munich, but that was the aim when he brought Nelson in, and I think he's been proven. On his debut away at Dusseldorf, he scored the equaliser for Hoffenheim. Of course, they did then go on to lose to a late penalty, but the equaliser was fantastic. He pounced on a loose ball on the edge of the box, and just with his first touch, darted past the Dusseldorf defender and into the box, and then with his next touch, left foot, from quite a narrow angle, smashed a low shot across the face of goal and into the back of the net. Really, really clinical finish. And he showed that finishing power again on Saturday, wasn't it? The Nuremberg-Hoffenheim game. Nuremberg were 1-0 up from a first-half penalty, but it was 2 goals from Reece Nelson that turned the game around for Hoffenheim. And 2 quite different sort of goals as well, I think. The first one, if anyone's seen it, it was like a volley taken immediately on the turn, sort of on the swivel, about 7 yards out after the ball was knocked back in by, I think, Kadarabek or Kramaric. Kadarabek, I think it was, sort of cushions the ball back in, and Reece Nelson's there in the middle of the box, just outside the 6-yard box, and immediately just bang with his right foot on the volley, smashes the ball home. So a really clinical finish, knew exactly where the goal was. And the second goal, he's anticipated it because it's fallen to, I think it's gone past at least 1 or 2 Hoffenheim players in the box, and it's fallen to Nelson at the back post from a really tight angle. But he's seen it coming. He's read the ball, he's anticipated it, and he's he cushioned it into the roof of the net. So two quite difficult, quite different finishes. In total 3. He's scored 4 in total, hasn't he? So he's showing a different range of finishing, and clearly not fazed by a starting role, and fits that Hoffenheim system quite well.
Yeah, I think that's the key point, right? Is that he fits the Hoffenheim system, and that he's actually with the right coach, because Nagelsmann has. He is not only just I don't think he is just a good tactician. I think he actively tries to make players better. I mean, you see him completely rejuvenate Adam Salai's career. And if you are an England fan and you saw that move in the summer of Reece Nelson going to Hoffenheim, I think many were justifiably ecstatic that he will be working under Julian Nagelsmann.
You've only got to look at where some ex-Hoffenheim players have ended up. Roberto Firmino was a big one at Liverpool, obviously.
Yeah. I don't know actually if he coached for it, but
do you not play under Nagelsmann?
I'm not sure about that. But one thing, but there's definitely other. Prominent examples for sure.
Definitely the likes of Zula and Rudy at Bayern, and obviously Mark Hoots ends up at Schalke. There's certainly no doubt in the relationship that Nagelsmann has with young players. And well, by all accounts, Nelson himself pointed, I was reading an interview that he did with the English FA, where he said that he didn't want to go on loan. You know, he's a London lad. I think his dream is still to play for Arsenal. Fair enough. But he said,
granted, I wouldn't want to go to Hoffenheim on loan either. if I had visited Hoffenheim before, I wouldn't want to go on Hoffenheim either.
I wonder where the atmosphere is better, Hoffenheim or Arsenal. That's a debate for another day. That's a debate for another day. But he said that he wasn't interested in a loan deal, but when he heard that Nagelsmann was interested in working with him, he said, yeah, I'm going to go for it, because he'd heard about that reputation, and by all accounts they got on well. Nelson said that he likes the fact that Nagelsmann's is obviously so much younger. He's only about 11, 12 years older than Nelson himself.
I think he's considered a millennial still. I think even though Nagelsmann is probably the end of the millennial scale, I think he's still a millennial. I'm not sure when the millennial scale ends. I don't know if Reese Nelson... I did it again. I don't know if Reese Nelson is on the is in the millennial generation. Someone will probably correct me on that. Yeah. But I think what was interesting today about... Nagelsmann, of course, spoke before their game against Lyon on Tuesday. And they... And he said he basically tried to temper the expectations of the kid because I'm sure that a lot of English press has jumped onto him, especially after a two-goal performance. Nagelsmann doesn't want Nelson to be a one-hit wonder. The goal here is to have a long 15-year career. And that's definitely the right approach from a coach trying to develop young talent. But, I mean, it's hard not to get caught up in what he's doing right now, especially when you consider, like you said, the players that he's developed. The one thing that I'm always cautioned about, though, is I really don't know how to kind of treat Nagelsmann players, because when they leave that system, they don't necessarily always succeed. I mean, you see Sebastian Rudi, who succeeded with Germany after spending time under Nagelsmann, but never really broke into Bayern, left the next year, now sitting on the bench with Schalke. Mm. You have Niklas Süle, who is probably the best of the bunch, but still has not gotten a regular place in Bayern's team. And then you look at Marcuta as the prominent example of a player who was scoring for fun last season, but has yet to score for Schalke after 8 match days. And so I would, in that sense, I'm cautiously optimistic. But I think the play that you really have to compare him, like you said, was Gnabry, and you see what Gnabry's doing at Bayern Munich now, rejuvenating their play from the flanks, and that's the kind of player that Reese Nelson is. And perhaps if you're an Arsenal fan and you're looking on, and you're looking, I mean, could Nelson start in place of Henrik Mkhitaryan next season? Is that so unreasonable to say now? Maybe that's going too far.
Might be looking a little bit too far ahead at the moment.
Yeah, that might be a take that still needs a little bit more work. But it's not as ludicrous as it was maybe earlier this season.
Yeah, well, I think the key there is to focus on what Nagelsmann. Well, you said it. What Nagelsmann said today, in that, you know, let's not get carried away. The lad's young. He's in the right place. He's working at the right sort of club. For all Hoffenheim's faults, and we've discussed them before. The way they train young players in that very, very specific system, heavy reliance on data and sports science, really meticulous planning from Nagelsmann and his team. Circumstances which aren't always completely appropriate in top level football, as we've said, because they don't necessarily have the time if they're playing in Europe in the week and in the Bundesliga at the week, and they don't often have the time to really get the best out of the structures and the techniques they use at Hoffenheim. But I think generally speaking, he's definitely in the right place. He's in the right place in the Bundesliga in terms of young players getting games. We're going to get on to Jadon Sancho as well, aren't we? Because obviously he's been making most of the headlines, you know, Borussia Dortmund being about a million times bigger than Hoffenheim. But he's benefited from the same confidence in and the willingness to play young players that these Nelson is as well. They're not the first, are they?
Yeah, well, let's get on to Jadon Sancho since you mentioned him, because he is definitely the talk of the town now for sure, because he's also made... he's also been called into the England squad now as well after his performances with Borussia Dortmund. Now, I do have to admit that I am actually not as high on Jadon Sancho as some other people are. I do recognize that he is only a teenager, but I do think that the 8 assists, of course, speak for themselves. I mean, a player that scores 8 assists.
You're going to compare him to Pulisic, though, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I'm actually not going to compare him to Pulisic because actually, I think that they both should be starting at the same time. Although I do actually think that his impact has been better than Pulisic's. But it's just, I would be very. I'm worried also in terms of also Reese Nelson. Is he a product of the system rather than just a good player that's technically good? You still see him trying to force balls in between players' legs and trying to feed Marco Reus. in any other system that might be damaging. But in Dortmund's, it doesn't matter because it's a much more open attacking system. So I'm cautiously optimistic about Jadon Sancho's immediate impact in the Bundesliga.
I think you're being slightly harsh, but I do, on the other hand, think he benefits from being surrounded by Royce and Paco Alcacer, who he's struck up a rapport with them two, both on the pitch and off it, by all accounts as well. The three of them get on really, really well by all accounts. We see it on the pitch in front of our own eyes. I think the standout moment, or two standout moments for me, was Sancho's combinations with Royce against Leverkusen, and the way Sancho linked up with Alcacer against Frankfurt. I think he fits into it really, really well. I think the sort of football that Lucien Favre has Dortmund playing, it's the ball on the ground, quick, slick passing, looking for the ball to the man on the shoulder, into the spaces in behind, not relying on simply getting it out wide and crosses into the box to, maybe in the past it would have been a Batshuayi or Lewandowski or Aubameyang in the middle there for Dortmund. This time they're feeding balls into a player in Alcacer who's looking for that ball into feet or into the space in front where they can run onto it. And I think that's where Jadon Sancho is proving with his eight assists that's a game that absolutely suits him perfectly. Of course, sometimes they're not always going to come off. He is young. He's going to make incorrect decisions. And you could argue that maybe the Bundesliga is, for want of a better word, weak enough to allow him to afford those mistakes.
Yeah,
they're not necessarily going to get punished the way he might do on the break, were he ever to have made that mistake in a first team game for Manchester City. Obviously, we'll never know because I don't think he ever got one, did he?
Yeah, it's just within. It depends. It's all relative, right? I mean, in the Bundesliga, this is very impressive. I mean, you saw Kevin De Bruyne get 20 assists with Wolfsburg, and he was a very impactful player almost right away when returning to England.
So does that mean that Sancho's going to go the same way? He's going to come to Germany for a year or two and then head back?
That's the question. I mean, I think a lot of England, I might be speaking out of turn, but I think a lot of English fans are expecting him to come back to go back.
I think a lot to the Insel. I get that impression.
Yeah, so
back to the island with the rest of the monkeys.
Of course, Borussia Dortmund is going to profit extremely off of a transfer back to England, but I just wonder if he goes. I mean, it depends on when he goes back. I mean, he's still to me a player that probably would. I would not want him to go back after this season. He is going to have I think he's going to put it together a very impressive season, but I think if he goes back, he's going to have expectations that are much too high for the player he is now. He will develop into a very good player.
I totally agree. I think when Kevin De Bruyne went back, even compared to Sancho, he was at a much more advanced, stage of his career. If Sancho was to go. I was to go back even in summer, even next summer, I would think that would be too. I think that would be too early. If it was him, it depends on the development he makes. The way Dortmund are playing this year, if they keep up this form, we could maybe, touch wood, have a title race. Who knows where this Borussia Dortmund team could go, and who knows what sort of how important a role Sancho can play in that team.
You also look in the context of the England national team. I mean, you see the amount of criticism that Raheem Sterling got for so many years when he put on an England shirt. And it's great that Jadon Sancho is getting a call-up, and it's great that Gareth Southgate is being progressive with his squad choices and is not just relying on the same players that took him to the semifinals of the World Cup, which is what he's supposed to do in this stage. But I just would like to manage expectations. I did the same thing with Christian Pulisic.
No, definitely, I totally agree.
And I'm an American. I definitely love Christian Pulisic, but I definitely think that some of the praise with Christian Pulisic and with Jadon Sancho may have been. I mean, some people were talking about Christian Pulisic being a future Ballon d'Or winner when he was 18, and I'm 19, and I'm like, we were still far away from him becoming even a Gareth Bale, for that matter.
No, I totally agree, and I think I definitely agree that the expectations among a lot of English clubs, fans, media, the whole lot, are slightly exaggerated, and that's not to sit here being all holier than thou, because we live in Germany, we work on the Bundesliga, with the greatest league in the world, and not trying to say that at all. We have our own faults and issues over here, but one of them is certainly not hyping, overhyping young players. I've already seen rumours during the round. I've no idea if they're true or not, that Man City have got a buyback guarantee or buyback clause in the contract when they sold him to Dortmund. No idea if that's true or not, but the fact that those rumours are swirling, to me sends the wrong signal, because at the moment that would be a mistake for Sancho. He needs to develop here. He's at exactly the right place in the right league and at the right club for the time being.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Tribuna Weekly. If you want to talk about these topics more, you can always reach out to us on social media. But also be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you do, do us a favor. Leave us a friendly review. You can follow Matt Ford on Twitter at Matt_4D. And I'm at Davis_Knopdorp. And you can always follow the podcast at Tribuna Podcast on Twitter. There's going to be a lot of stuff happening this week, so we'll have plenty to talk about on next week's show. So we hope to hear from you next week.